Okay, so everybody, thanks for coming. So it's my pleasure to introduce Mojitaba Chokbienzini, who's going to tell us some very interesting recent work that he has done on measurement-based quantum computing with equiangular projection. So he will tell us probably something about Octonians as well in this talk.
Yeah. All right. So shall I start?
Yes, please, please.
Okay. All right. Thank you for having me, John, and thanks to everyone. So today I'm going to talk about a common theme that exists among measurement-based quantum computational models, and we're going to see that the resources, the measurements that are used in these models, they satisfy some property, and that is basically equiangularity of the projections. So this is a joint work with Mike Friedman and my advisor, Zhenghong Wang. All right, so the outline of the talk will be as follows. First, we're going to discuss no leakage, which is a requirement that you would want to have on the information that is being processed. And we're going to see how this relates to the equiangularity of the projections in the measurements. Then we'll see how this is also manifested in previous measurement-based quantum computation paradigms, such as the cluster states and the topological measurement model. Then I will discuss the original motivation of this work, which was to build chemically protected models, and what we are focusing on right now, which is to build universal models using the projections coming from symmetries of lattices. And finally, I will spend the rest of my time discussing how Octonians surprisingly show up when we want to build a universal model using a continuous family of what will be called strongly equiangular projections. So, right. So now, when we do computation, of course, in general, we don't want the information being destroyed, and so we don't want that to be leaked out to the environment. Now, in quantum unitary circuits, in the ideal scenario, we know that unitary gates are just reversible, so there's really no leakage on that part. But when it comes to measurements, just by theory, we have leakage, and so now we want to see that what properties these measurements they need to satisfy so that we have no leakage. Now, in order to investigate that, we can start with some simple measurements. These are projective measurements. And whenever I say projective measurements, I always mean measurement that is of the form P1 minus P. Now, what no leakage means here is that what the property should be between P and Q to ensure no leakage is that if you start from a random state in P, then you apply a measurement, the Q measurement, you do not want to get any statistical information about where the state was in P after observing the result of your measurement. So let me illustrate that in an actual example. Let's assume that you have two K and K prime dimensional planes. Recall that these two planes, they have K dihedral angles, the smaller dimension, of course, and dihedral angles, or maybe principal angles, these are the angles between planes. And cosine is the singular values of QP, which is the square root of the eigenvalues of TQ. So just that's a reminder. So now let's take an extreme example. P is the y plane, and Q is the xy plane. So they share an axis, so it's y axis. So one of the dihedral angle is zero, and the other one is pi half. Now, if you have a state and its projection, you perform a measurement, and you get 1 minus Q as a result, then you will rightfully suspect that psi probably made one of the larger possible angles in Q. And in this case, it means that it has a higher Z direction. And so you see that because the dihedral angles were not equal. One of them was zero and the other was pi. You're getting some information, statistical information, about where the state was in P. So this is some sort of a leakage. And therefore, that is why no leakage definitely implies that all the dihedral angles have to be. That's equiangular. Now, we want to get the other direction, of course, that equiangularity implies leakage. And that is not too hard to observe. So the linear algebra of equiangularity says that if P and Q are equiangular, then you have this simple identity that PQP is alpha squared times, where the scaling here is the cosine of the cosine of the dihedral angle squared. If the dimension of the planes are equal, then of course you have the other identity as well, where the P and Q exchange. Now, you observe from this identity that when you apply Q of P, this is essentially acting as some sort of a unitary on plane P. And when you apply P again, that's basically the conjugate of the unitary. And so you get back to P. Of course, this is not exactly unitary. It's a unitary of some scale, and that scale is alpha here, the cosine of the dihedral angle. So in other words, since we have this reversibility, basically, we do have no leakage as well. Alternatively, we could have actually started this whole discussion by saying that we want reversibility of the computation on P. And just by going through the linear algebra, it turns out that this leads to the same concept of equiangularity and the same identity that we have. Now, finally, just a quick note. So we know that you have three unitary operations. The tensor product and the direct sum is also unitary. And since these equiangular projections are going to be resources for measurement-based quantum computational model, we want to know how they behave on the tensor product direct sum. And their behavior is simple. The tensor product is a equiangular pair. And direct sum, well, it's only so when the scalars of your pairs alpha 1 and alpha 2 are equal. So that's kind of like the behavior on these two operations. Now, in an explicit matrix form, you can also check two projections are equiangular if you're given the matrix form of P and Q. After diagonalizing one of them, the other one should be of this particular form, satisfying these identities. So this is just show that it's not really important for our discussion, but this is just show that you can look at the matrices and say if they're equiangular or not. Now, so going back to the whole purpose of this, that we want to simulate the quantum unitary circuit, these equiangular projections. So we're going to compose them. Let's suppose that our computational space is in P1. Then we apply P2 on P1. P2 is equiangular with P1. So this is like a unitary operation on P1. And then P3 on P2 is a unitary operation on P2, and so on and so forth, until we get back to P1. So this should be like a unitary operation computational space. Now, obviously, you want the consecutive pairs to be equiangular. And what that means is that the dimension of all the PIs have to be equal. Because we're starting from P1 and we're going all the way back to P1. So because of the equiangularity requirement, the dimension of P2 has to be at least P1, P3 at least out of P2. So on and so forth until we get to P1. Now, of course, this this requirement of the dimensions being equal is not really desired. It's too stringent, and as we shall see in a topological model, we would want the angularity to be just on some restricted subspace. And in this case, well, it's kind of obvious what the requirement should be, which is the equiangularity should be only should be respected, basically. Only when we restrict on the image of the previous projections. So the identity basically becomes something like this, where you, if you project, if you consider the image of your previous projections, you have a triangularity on that. You don't need to have the triangularity on the whole plane of PI, basically. And therefore, from that, we can see that the requirement of the dimensions being all equal is lifted. And we just need the dimension of PI to be at least that of one. So this is just a quick generalization that we can make with our previous discussion, and that is indeed need, as we shall see, in the topological imaging model. Now, so far, well, we have assumed that we're always getting the measurement outcome that we wanted. So we applied the measurement that corresponds to P2, and we assume that we are getting P2, but that's not always the case. There might be failures. Now, if no leakage is really no leakage, I mean, if our discussion was right, then it should allow us to, if a failure happens, it should allow us to go back and try again the measurement until we force the desired outcome. So sometimes if you hear a forced measurement model, by force, this is what it meant. It's about forcing the desired outcome. So, well, let's assume that P and Q are triangular, and we start from P, but next measurement that is applied, we get actually 1 minus Q instead of Q. Well, in that case, what we're going to do is that we're going to try the measurement P 1 minus P again. And there are 2 cases. Let's suppose we get P. Well, we can just simplify this, and that gives us P back. This scaling here, it doesn't matter. It's a real scaling and a quantum mechanical. It's a unitary. This is going to get rid of this scaling here. So we get back to P, and we try the Q measurement again. Now, imagine that instead of getting P here, we got 1 minus P. Well, in that case, we try the Q measurement, and there are 2 cases again. Either we get Q or 1 minus Q. If we get Q, we're actually going to get, after simplification of this, we actually get Q. And that is exactly what we wanted from the beginning. So we're good here. Or we're going to get 1 minus Q, and then in that case, we're back to the kind of like failed result of 1 minus Q. So we start again with applying P, and basically we get to try this again and again until we get to Q. So how many trials are going to be needed? Well, that depends on the cosine of the angle between P and Q, right? So if you're unlucky and the angles between P and Q are quite large, so their cosine is quite small, you're going to have to try this a lot more. But usually, measurement-based model, you have a fixed set of measurements that you're applying here and there, and their angles are therefore fixed. And so by repetition, the failure probability is going to be exponentially stressed. In other words, you can always force the desired outcome in an efficient way. Now, where do we see this equiangularity in previous measurement-based quantum computing paradigms? So I should note that the universality of the models that we're going to discuss, it's partially due to the equiangular projections that are going to be used. But in some cases, and the extreme case of clusters, it's actually mostly perhaps due to the preparation phase, which is how we prepare the state before we start the measurements. So in the case of a cluster state, first of all, we pretty much do all of the entanglement before we start the computation using these measurements. And so an entangled state is presumed as the initial state on the lattice. Now, the way the model works is that measurements are applied on sites, and the measurements are just single qubit measurements. And so they're obviously going to be equiangular, because if you have a single qubit measurements, these are just a line in C2, right? And lines are always equiangular. There's not a lot of interesting equiangular projections there. And like you said, this is because very much of preparation that is being done first. Now, another thing is that failure in this model, it really doesn't happen. We actually should probably say we don't have a force measurement model here. We have an adaptive measurement model, because your measurement is always going to give you the result that you want, up to some factor that is expressed by some product of Pauli matrices. And ultimately, at the very end of your computation, there is a classical way of getting rid of these Pauli matrix products, basically. So any outcome of a measurement tells what next measurement should be. There's not a really case of failure by design. So in this case of cluster states, although equiangularity is there, I mean, we must have equiangularity because we must have no leakage. The equiangular projections we have that are not really that interesting. But in the case of topological force measurement model, is definitely more interesting with respect. So just a quick recap on how this is done, topological model. The projections that we're going to use are going to be generated using temporal-lib algebra operators. And temporal-lib algebra operators, you take two anions, two quasi-particles, and they're always going to be conjugate to one another. So A star are two anions that are conjugate to one another. You fuse them to the vacuum, and from the vacuum you excite and you get a pair of these two anions back. And that's the temporal algebra operator. Now, notice that the triangularity of the temporal algebra operator is evident from the identities that they satisfy. This is exactly that PQP equals some scaling P that we had previously in equilibrium. So we have these projections. We're also going to have two ancilla anions, and we're going to use them to generate basically ultimately the braiding of the two anions that we have in our computational space. And we'll see that shortly. So in order to perform braiding, ultimately, we're going to have two ancillas. Here it's A bar. A bar is the same as A star. These are two conjugate anions. So we want to get this kind of diagram, and we're going to stack up three of these diagrams to get the braiding ultimately. So how do we get this diagram here? Well, this you can get it by applying two of those projections that we have. First, this a projection on this A and A bar here, the temporal-lib algebra operator, and another one on these two anions here, the A bar A and A bar. So if you stack them up, you can see that you get this this result. Now, of course, you may not get a fusion to the vacuum. This projection that we're making, it's part of a measurement, and the measurement can fail, and you can actually have the two anions fuse into some, not the vacuum, but into another anion, let's call it F1. Well, what do we do in that case? Well, just like when we applied Q after P and it failed, well, we applied P again, and then if that failed, we applied Q again. So basically, we do that iteratively, and ultimately, we're going to be able to get the fusion to the vacuum because, like I said, the failure probability is exponentially suppressed. And so ultimately, after some failures, you're going to get this fusion to the vacuum, and this turns out to be equal to up to some scaling to this diagram here. So this is very similar to this picture, right? I mean, you may fail sometimes, but ultimately, you're going to get what you wanted up to scale. All right, now notice also that let me get to this slide. Yeah. So so we're gonna stack up three of these projections by choosing judiciously the three anions that we want to apply these projections. And so by a clever choice of configuration, ultimately, we get this braiding. Now, braiding in this model is the unitary gate, basically. And it's going to be unitary gate on the information that is encoded by the entanglement between these two anions, the first one and the last one here. As like I said, these two anions here are going to be used as ancillas. We really don't care about their information. We're going to get rid of them ultimately. Now, notice that the measurements we made, temporal algebra operators, they're not projective. They're not of the form P1 minus P. That's because when you take the tensor product of two anions, they can fuse into many things. And so each of those anions presents a measurement outcome. So the framework we have here is actually quite complicated. It's not projective measurement, but we still have equiangularity. But equiangularity, we have that with respect to some restricted subspace. Like I said, we are concerned with the information that is encoded by the two anions that represent our computational subspace. These two anions, the antiparticles, they're ancillas, and we're not concerned about the information that comes from these two. So we have to project on the information that is encoded by the entanglement of the first and last anion. And so the sum of these projections is what forms the restricted subspace key. And, well, you have to check a bunch of equiangularity identities to see that everything is consistent, but they all follow from the temporal Lieb algebra identities and the diagrammatic calculus of the module tensor category that we're using here. Now, I'm going to discuss here the original motivation of this work. This actually started from an idea by Matthew Fisher, that his idea was that there's quantum computing happening in the biological environment, such as the human brain. And in order to provide evidence for that, he showed that there are actually molecules like the positron molecule, which have a long decoherence time when it comes to the information that is encoded by the spins of the atomic nuclei of some of their atoms, in this case, the phosphorus atoms. That long decoherence time, it exists even in very noisy environment, such as the biological environment. Now, we're not concerned with whether this claim of quantum computing human brain is true or not. But what is interesting to us is that it's possible to use molecules that, because of the rigidity that they have, because of the symmetry that they have, this it provides some sort of a chemical protection to the information that they have, they're encoding. And so topological protection is something that is a major theme. Maybe we actually have some other projections. And in this type of model, what acts as a measurement is is molecular binding. So let's just see how that works abstractly. Let's imagine that you have a molecule with Hilbert space H, and it has some symmetric group G. So for example, for the hydrogen H2, you have like a Z2 symmetry. Now, Hilbert space, it decomposes some of irreducible components of the group symmetry. If you have two molecules, binding should correspond to a projection to the irreducible to an irreducible sector of their tensor product. Now, not all projections are very likely realizable physically, and there is definitely some quantum chemistry involved in as to whether some particular projection is realizable or not. And I'm not super familiar with that, but so for example, in the case of Posner molecule, which Matthew Fisher analyzed, the projection is a projection onto the trivial irreducible representation of the symmetry. But just because we don't have yet a universal model and we're just doing this all of that mathematically, we can allow us some freedom and imagine that actually we can perform any projective measurement that we want if binding or not binding, basically, of the two molecules. So that's kind of like the abstract framework. Now, notice that this framework is actually quite rich. First of all, there may be multiple ways of binding two molecules because of their geometries and the symmetries they have. And that may correspond to different projections, really. Another thing is that you have entanglements between spins of the two molecules that could affect their binding probability. And that's something that is actually demonstrated in the case of the Posner molecule. So as you can see, the space of possibility that we have are quite rich. You could go even further. You could say, you have two molecules bind together, let's say, they form another molecule. It has a different symmetry. Some symmetry is broken, it has a different symmetry. Now you can think of binding this new molecule to some other molecule, basically. So you can see the space of possibility is rich. And that is why we believe that there should be something universal out there, a universal model using these configurations. But first, we have to study how these projections that are coming from symmetries, they actually behave. And perhaps just like as a start, we can think of, so we can think of actually looking at, planar tiles. Because the symmetry they provide and the projections that correspond to them are, simple, at least simpler than that of the molecules. So, for example, we can start with the most simple planar tiling, perhaps triangle tiling. So, on each triangle, you have three qubits. And this is a C8, basically. There's a C3 rotation. It turns out that if you look inside a trivial irreducible representation here, it has dimension 4, we can find a two-dimensional subspace that is equiangular to the measurement on the eigenspace, on the irreducible sectors of Z3. So P omega, P omega bar, and P0, these are the projections of the irreducible sectors. And P0 is the projection on the trivial. But you know, this is all. I don't have a lot to share here because this is something that we just started working on recently, and the gauge that we have been able to achieve so far, they're just either scalar by decomposition of these projections or some order three unitary matrix. And we haven't really been able to do something interesting with that either. We suspect that there may be some pre-entanglement pattern here is needed, a reasonable one, not like the cluster state where pretty much all the entanglement is done prior to starting the computation. Yeah, so if that doesn't work, I mean, we could probably go to more complicated tilings, like the Penrose tiling. So you have two basically shapes here, like the square and the triangle, the other tiles that we can explore as well. So it's quite a rich space. We're hopeful that there is something universal out. All right. Now, let me spend the rest of my time discussing the Hamiltonian story here. So we, you know, when we started this work, we asked ourselves, we can just work with some equiangular projections without any using any fancy frameworks like topological model or any pre-tanglement. Just very simple, a bunch of equiangular projections. Can you get some universal model just by composition of these? In order to, you know, explore this vaster space more efficiently, we restricted ourselves to a stronger case of equiangularity. And that is when your projections are not just equiangular, but their complements are also equiangular. And what that plots is that, well, the projections have the same rank, and the rank is equal to half of the Hilbert space. And so the question is, if this restricted form of equiangularity can give universal schemes. Now, we can start very simple. The first example that comes to mind of strongly equiangular projections is this space complex lines in C. So, you know, lines of the form XAX, and it turns out these are strongly equiangular. If you take the projections on these lines, these are R2 subspaces, we can look at them as they have a matrix form, and because the matrix, the real matrix representation of a complex number is always some unitary up to some scale, it turns out that the projection takes the more simpler form. Now, by using this matrix form, we can actually calculate the angle between P and P A. P is this sort of arc sign of this expression in terms of the norm of A and B. And as you'd expect, when you go from P A to P B, when you go from a complex line to another, it's a multiplication by complex number, something that is that's like A star times B, right? So you get a rotation, SO2, and that is not universal. Now, the next natural step is to consider the quaternionic lines. Now, in that case, just like the previous one, we need a matrix representation of the quaternions and a vector representation of the quaternions in order to actually embed these lines as subspaces, as R4 subspaces. So the quaternions, they naturally form the algebra of unitaries up to some scale in 2x2 matrices with entries in C. And the vector representation we're going to use, well, it's just the obvious one. If you have a quaternion X, well, you're going to have this vector representation of the quaternion. And with that, you get what you expect again, that going from PA to PB is going to be an action by quaternion. And because of the representation we chose here, it's going to be a unitary up to some scale, in unitary that is a 2x2 matrix. So we're going to get all the gays in your city. This is still not universal. And so we jump to the next one. Final stop here, which is the octonionic. Now, these are RH subspaces. And we might expect to get SU4 here. But we actually get something more, which is SO8, which has real dimension 28. And that is due to the non-associativity of the octonions. So octonions, they do not have, just like quaternions or the complex numbers, they do not have any natural matrix representations because, well, linear operators are associated. So they, but the octonions are non-associated. So you can never have actually a homomorphism. So, but we're still going to choose something that is very close to representation. And that is at least going to sort of respect the product of the base elements of the octonions. And so that's not hard, too hard to do. So if you look at the basis elements of the octonions, let's call them EI, you can embed them as vectors, just the standard orthonormal basis of R8. And you can also consider them as matrices, which I'm going to denote them by this EI here, capital EI. And what we want to have is that this product basically holds. And this is basically the product rules of the octonions. So at least this pseudo representation that we have, it respects the product of the octonion based cells. Now, how do we get SO8 from that? Just a quick sketch of the proof. Well, the Lie algebra of SO8 is actually generated by EI star J. And this is a term that appears when we are going to take the composition of projections of EI and EJ, right? So when we go from the line that corresponds to EI to the line that corresponds to EJ, that's a term that appears. So that's a good thing. Now, there's also this general fact that if you have a basis of the Lie algebra of a Lie group, then their exponentials of the lines, they generate the Lie group. So using that, we would want to ideally want to basically show that a composition of these projections, strongly angular projections, gives us exactly product of the exponential of these basis elements of the Lie algebra. And that's indeed the case. If we make a wise choice of the projections that we are using, then we can actually implement any product of the exponentials of these Lie algebra elements. So we can, because of this fact here, we can actually implement SO8. And how many, if you want to know, like, how many projections are we going to need to implement any gate in SO8? Well, so the question basically becomes, how many of these exponentials are we going to need? And turns out that it's exactly equal to the dimension of the algebra, that is 28. So since actually we are using P0 here repeatedly, that's like 3 times 28 plus 1 or 2. So anyway, somewhere, I guess, around 80, is that 84, 85, 86 elements that you have to use, 84 projections that you have to use to get any gate SO. So that is universal. Now, let's look at the problem in a more general perspective. So far, we've been looking at the complex lines, quaternionic lines, and octonionic lines. So this is CP1, HP1, and OP1. but we stopped there. So why is that? Why we can't go further? So in general, if you take a continuous n-dimensional manifold of equiangular n-planes, in other words, strongly equiangular planes, that is essentially a submanifold. You can look at it as a submanifold of dimension n in the Grassmannian of 2n. Now, there's another thing that you have to consider, which is these planes are strongly equiangular. And what that implies about their geometry and topology with respect to one another is that they have no non-trivial intersection. They only intersect at the origin. That's because of the equiangularity assumption. Notice that if you have two planes that are equiangular, and if they intersect non-trivially, then they have a dihedral angle which is equal to zero. So since all dihedral angles have to be equal, so all dihedral angles are equal to zero, so they have to be equal. The projections have to be equal. So two projections have no non-trivial intersection. And now if you look at the spheres that these planes give you on the S2n minus 1 and R2n, they create a sphere Sn minus 1. Then all these spheres, they have to be disjoint, and they have to have linking number 1 because of the intersection that you have at the origin of the equations. So for example, for n equals 2, right? So for n equals 2, for the case of complex lines, you have R4 here. You have the complex lines are R2 subspaces, two-dimensional planes. They intersect a three-sphere in a circle, outer circle, right? And all these circles, they have to be disjoint, and they have to have linking number 1. And that's exactly, for people who are familiar, this is exactly the Hopf vibration, famous Hopf vibration of S3. And so, for people who are familiar with Hopf vibration, the story behind it, we know that Hopf maps only exist for n equals 1, 2, 4, 8. And that is due to Adam's theorem. That also relates to the story of division ring extensions of R, which only exist for these particular dimensions. So that implies that if you have a continuous n-dimensional manifold of equiangular n-planes, then you must have n equals 1, 2, 4, 8. And so that is why the octonions are the only universal model that you can get as a collection of strongly equiangular planes. Of course, we can do a little bit better if we want to investigate. We can think of a k-dimensional manifold as well, where k is smaller than n. And well, the idea here is that if you have a k-dimensional manifold, you might be able to extend it to an n-dimensional manifold, and so use the theorem that we have up here above. But that is there is some obstruction here, and the obstruction it relates to the vanishing of some higher homotopy group. And well, this higher homotopy group, there are results for it. There are a lot of people have studied it before. For k equals n minus 1, n minus 2, we can get vanishing of this higher homotopy group, so we have the same kind of result. And there are some other pairs of n and k for which this higher homotopy group still vanishes. So if we put all of that together, we get this sort of color-coded plot, where the blue dots here they represent the known existence, the proven existence of a k-dimensional continuous family of strongly equiangular planes. And the red dots here they represent the proven absence of k-dimensional continuous families, so of a strongly equiangular planes. So as you can see, these first few blue dots here, they come from the complex lines, quaternionic lines, and octonionic lines. And the ones you have here all the way, they come from the direct sum of these. So we just direct sum the pairs that we have here, and we can go to the higher dimensions of it. Anyway, so we can get basically this kind of graph, and any result regarding the vanishing of this help us fill out this graph a little bit more. I guess I'm going to wrap up the talk. So like I mentioned, the work here started because we were interested that there might be some other form of protection, protection against noise in the environment, like a call protection. And we started thinking about how to build the universal models, realized that there's something missing in the literature, some sort of a guideline, something that would tell us what kind of measurements are allowed in the measurement-based models. So that's what we first decided to study, to be a little bit more principled. And turns out that acuangular planes are the resources for measurement-based quantum computing. There are other topics where acuangularity appears, like that of seek GOVM optimal packings. We didn't really delve much into any of these, but I mean, there is a connection, an apparent connection there, because of the fact that these acuangular projections, they also appear there, and they might provide some sort of a resource or ideas to have a universal models of a universal model of using acuangular projections. Like I said, these have literature of their own, and I'll be happy to talk a little bit more about this if anyone's interested. Yeah, so these are the differences, and thank you very much. That's all.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
Could you say one more time? I missed it. So the motivation for looking at equiangular projections is that you don't leak to the environment. What was the motivation for looking at your strong at this the stronger strong equiangularity condition?
Yes. So like I mentioned, we wanted to. This was just something that we wanted to do. That we wanted to build a universal model by only using acuangular projections, the most simplest form. We didn't want to use any fancy framework like a topological model and exploit a topological properties that you have in a topological model, or exploit some pre-entanglement of the initial state. We just wanted to use these projections on starting from the most simple configuration, which is you can think of starting, for example, with a state that is the spin up tensor n times, right? So you have really nothing else, and you want to start with this and apply acuangular projections and build some universal model out of that. So the reason we now consider it strongly acuangular is because in the search space is quite large. We thought perhaps if we restrict ourselves to a more restricted form of acuangularity, that would make our job easier to figure out some universal model. There is very likely collections of acuangular projections that are discrete and that are not strongly acuangular, and that provide also universal. But the reason, again, as that went to the strongly acuangular was just to make our job easier, basically. That was it. And it was just a surprise that this was also related to octonions, as we just observed. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say that there's this, you did CP1 and HP1 and OP1, but if you go up to the projective planes, and including OP2, then there's this, that's a kind of very beautiful special space also, and associated with the exceptional Jordan algebra, and there's this known set of 27 equiangular projectors, which are not strongly equiangular, I guess, in your
sense. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think actually Mike Friedman, I mean, so I think we had this sort of discussion. You're right, and I guess we didn't really explore it, but you're right that, I mean, this is probably not going to be, I mean, this is not going to be a continuous collection of strongly equiangular planes because of the theorem that we just saw, yeah.
But I bet it'll be super interesting.
Yeah.
So are you envisioning picking some finite set that's equiangular and then computing with that? Is that the gist?
Yeah. So basically, what we're working on right now, Yeah. So right now. Our hope is that there is some lattice, perhaps a planar tiling, just that is symmetric enough. And using the projections that come from the symmetries of these lattices, and the composition of these projections, we can get some universal model. Maybe there is some pre-entanglement that we have to assume, but it has to be a reasonable one. But yeah, that's basically our goal here, that if we can have something, a discrete collection of equiangular planes, a fixed discrete collection of equiangular planes, finite one, of course, that are going to give us a universal model. And ideally, of course, because of this chemical protection discussion that we had, we want these projections to come from symmetries of groups, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I want to ask a question about this chemically protected. It's actually so. I must admit I really didn't follow the idea. But so the idea is like you have crystal symmetry and like you talk about gates which are symmetric and so. Could you explain these things again?
I couldn't hear it well. But
can you speak up?
So what's the role of symmetries here?
Okay. So so that's again that's a discussion of the quantum chemistry basically. But and that's something that Matthew Fischer. Explores in his paper.
That I understand, but let's say like you have concrete proposal, like you have let's say triangular lattice, and then it has the G3 symmetry, and then So what's the role of G3 here? Like, the gates are restricted by the symmetry, or so?
Okay. I see. So so when you have a symmetry group, you have your Hilbert space, the Hilbert space that you walk. Because of the action of the symmetry group, it decomposes into irreducible sectors.
Okay.
And turns out that binding of molecules corresponds to a projection on one of these irreducible sectors.
Yeah.
So that's how the projections you have relate to the symmetry. There are always going to be a projection on some irreducible sector. So in this case of Z3, you have, Z3 is abelian, so its reducible sectors are always represented by its elements, 1, 0, omega, and omega bar. And so we have corresponding projections on those irreducible sectors.
So, maybe you already explained, but what kind of initial state I should prepare for this?
That's a good question. So.
I have an impression that your entire discussions more like operators, and then there's not much mentioning about states and
So you know, ideally you would say that just start from a all spin-up basis, right? All spin-up basis. So that would be the ideal picture, where you start from that, and you do your computation. But probably that's not going to be the case. There might be some pre-entanglement that we're going to need to have. In this case, for example, like I mentioned, there's a restricted two-dimensional subspace, which is akin angular to these measurements. We probably want to be able to start from that two-dimensional subspace from the beginning.
Yeah.
So we have to look at what that is and find a way of realizing that entanglement first before we start our measurement. But that, of course, is, here's a way perhaps of preparing that this particular one is that, you know, you apply P0 first as many times as it is needed to actually get a projection on the trivial reducible representation.
Okay.
And then you can actually try a composition of these P omega and P gamma bar to make sure that the state you started with actually is a particular state in this restricted two-dimensional subspace. So there is a way of actually making even this preparation just by starting from, you know, all spin-up bases.
Okay, but yeah. I have an impression, like, for example, condensed matter physicists have studied symmetry protected topological phases in the presence of crystal symmetries, and then we sort of know that SPD phases are resources for measurement-based quantum computation. So, these ideas of, let's say, G3, does it fit into this classification of SPD phases?
When it comes to resources for universal measurement-based models, in fact, there is a paper by Younger Halpern and her colleague that you can actually use the Poisson molecule and some operations.
But they don't use much symmetry properties, if I remember correctly.
Sorry?
Do they use symmetries of the crystal lattice or no, right?
Oh, so what they use ultimately is that they put these Poisson molecules in configuration that is an AKLT honeycomb lattice.
Yeah. But do they explicitly use the symmetry of the AKLT lattice? I mean, AKLT is like example of
a
SPD phase, right?
Well, so I'm not sure if I understand the question, but what they do is that by some operations that are allowed using the Poisson molecule, just binding them and stuff like that, they ultimately form some AKT lattice. And from that, you can get a cluster state. That's a fact.
Sure. My question is, what is protected here?
Oh, the protected here is the information that is inside. In this case of the partner, it's the information that is encoded by the spin of the phosphorus atoms.
Yeah.
So you have the spin of the phosphorus, I think, so you have C2 tensor 6 times. That's the information that is encoded by Poisson molecule. And there is. And this is information that has a long decoherence time.
Yeah. Okay, so the proposal is to use such molecules to do measurement-based quantum computations, or?
Yes, by binding them and trying to, that's the kind of measurement we have. There might be other things, like I discussed, you know, but that's the primary thing.
Okay.
So, away from this strongly equiangular regime, do you think there might be more efficient ways than this kind of repeat until success?
So the repeat until success is, you usually get a, so for example, for the cluster state, it's very efficient with regards to that, because there's really no failure, like I discussed. It's adaptive measurement, right? You always get the result that you want, modulo some product of Pauli matrices. Mm-hmm. And you know what these the powers of these Pauli matrices are, exactly what they are, because of the from the observation that you get of the measurement. But in general, just like topological model, you do have failure. It's just inevitable. And there's always going to be something that is a desired outcome. And you usually want to force that. And, well, the more, you know, it all depends on that angle that I discussed, the angle of the desired measurement outcome and the previous measurement that you made. The angle is, if it is smaller, then you're lucky, you're going to have to try it less, definitely. So for example, in the case of, I mean, you can think of adiabatic quantum computation, perhaps, as kind of like that, right? Because you're evolving the Hamiltonian, and you can also think of it as, because you're doing this so continuously, you can also think of it as making projections on planes that are very close to each other. And you're doing that sort of like continuously. That's kind of like perhaps another way of looking at adiabatic quantum computation. And it has a very high probability of success because these angles are just so small. Yeah.
I see. So you envision these angles being very small in the application?
Yeah. 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 Hopefully that should be the case. I mean, ultimately, they're going to be fixed, right? I mean, if you have a fixed set of measurements, they're going to be fixed. Probability is exponentially suppressed, failure. The smaller they are, the better, of course.
You said towards the end that you had some further comments that you could make on connections to sick POVMs.
Yeah, so perhaps I prepared the slides, but I wasn't sure like if there's time. I mean, so a sick POVM, for the audience who may not be noticed, that this is it's a positive operative valid measure where you have n squared possible outcomes. And these are rank one projections that span the linear space on the Hilbert space. That's the minimal informationally complete condition. And they also have to be symmetric. So that's the S in sig here. And the symmetry, if you look at the condition here, it's basically saying that the angles between the lines are all equal. So you know, when we looked at that, we thought, perhaps it's the source for getting some discrete collection angular planes that also are in a very symmetric configuration, and at the same time, they're universal. So we're like hopeful here, but we just saw that actually this is a problem where even for lines rank on projections, it is not known yet if this kind of configuration still exists for all possible ends. But what we want to have, of course, is the generalization where you have actually rank D projections. Is bigger than one, probably four, or even eight, actually. And you would want the angles between all of them to be equal. But similar to here, where if all of their angles are equal, you can exactly say what the angle should be. And alpha here is also uniquely determined in terms of N and in terms of D. And if you have, for example, a strongly k-angular sig POVM, then turns out you can actually calculate the alpha here. In the limit, they have an interesting behavior. They're going to have to meet at pi 4 degree. Pi 1 degree. So that's just, like I said, we didn't really delve into it, but I thought since there's a connection here, there might be some resource for measurement-based quantum computing. Yeah.
All right, thanks. Any more questions? All right, I think we're good.
Thank you very much again for having me. Yeah.
All right, thanks, Moji. I may be in touch with you if we need to discuss anything further. I'll find.
Okay. Oh, yeah, sure.
All
right.
Thanks again for the very interesting talk.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Thank you.
Okay.
Goodbye.